Many of you are not aware of Lostology, and so what I hope will happen by the end of this week is that a large percentage of you are going to decide that you're going to be Lostologist. Now, we know that any word that ends with the ology part of it is the study of something. So let's just do a quick check. I'm trying to figure out how many different things you can major in that end in ology. Somebody tell me a couple or one or what? Psychology. How many psychology majors do we have here? The study of psychos. We know this. This is a good one, okay? Psychology. What else do we have? What? Biology, the study of life. What else? Sociology. Okay, now we'll stop here a minute. Could all the sociology majors stand up? Keep standing, please. Did you get counseling before you chose this major? I was a sociology major. Do you have any intent of making a living with this major? See me later. You might want to consider something else. Some other major. You got anything else? Theology, the study of God. What else? I heard something. Pharmacology, the study of pharmacists or something. What's that? Drugs. No, we know what that is. What else? Zoology, the study of zoos. You want to work in a zoo? You study zoology. We got, what else? We got criminology. Anybody got a criminologist here? That's a good field. There's lots of that to work with, okay? What else? Huh? Oh, you're getting into subspecialties here. I mean, you're losing me. Listen, there's lots of things you can study. What I want to tell you about today is Lostology. Now, if anything that ends in ology is the study of, even if you're not a Lostologist, you know what it is, right? Lostology is the study of being lost. Okay, here's the technical definition. Lostology is the study of being lost and what that experience can teach Christians about evangelism. Now, by that, what we mean is being lost physically. Here's the idea. Every time that you get lost physically or lose something valuable and start looking for it, you are going to experience things and think things that will give you insights into how spiritually lost people think and feel as they search for God. I want to introduce you this morning to the first and greatest Lostologist. Jesus was the one that really gave us these insights. He didn't call it Lostology, but he could have because the teaching is straight from him. To help us get started, I'd like for you to turn to Luke chapter 15, which is the classic chapter in the Bible where Jesus gives us insights into Lostology. Luke chapter 15. Let's start in verse 1. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathered around to hear him, but the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Now, to help us get started in this morning, what I'd like for you to do is to see the groups of people that were there that day. To help us keep them straight, let's kind of put them here imaginary, like on stage. Over in this section, let's put those folks they call the what? The tax collectors and the sinners. We'll classify those folks as the spiritual outsiders. They were not comfortable with any of this stuff. They were just hanging out. Over on this side, the text tells us there was another group, the Pharisees. Let's call them the religious insiders. They were very comfortable with everything having to do with the religion of their day. In the middle, let's put Jesus, the Lostologist. And then behind, we've got this little chorus, 12 guys, Jesus' disciples, who were desperately trying to figure out what was going on. They were watching Jesus and trying to figure out, how do we respond to these people over here? Who are these folks? The outsiders. Now, here was the complicating factor. The folks over here, the Pharisees, the religious insiders, did not like those guys at all. They didn't want to be around them. They didn't want to have anything to do with them. They wanted to completely lock them out of the system unless they would agree to come in according to the rules. One of the charges these people like to level at Jesus was that He was the friend of tax collectors and sinners. I would have loved to have been there when they would have said that to Jesus. I don't know that He responded with words, but I think a big smile probably came across His face because I think He was saying, look guys, you're getting it right. Because Jesus has explained what His mission on earth was. Luke 19:10, Jesus said it this way, for the Son of Man came to seek and to save those who are what? Lost. Another time, Jesus was trying to explain to His disciples how the Father in heaven felt about spiritual outsiders, and He said this, in the same way, your Father in heaven is unwilling that any of these little ones should be lost. So when the religious insiders looked at Jesus and said, you are the friend of tax collectors and sinners, Jesus could have said, I think they're catching on here. That's why I came. But He had a problem. For you see, Jesus not only loved these folks, the outsiders, He loved these guys over here too. And He wanted desperately for something to happen in the hearts of these religious insiders as well as in the lives of His disciples. He had to do something to change the way they would think and feel about these folks. So how does He do that? Well, if he had done that like we tend to do it today, what He would have done is given them a crash course with lots of information about the theology of lostness. He could have lined up the people, put them in little rows, talked and talked and talked, and just given them volumes of information and data about all the theological truths about being spiritually lost. Probably what would have happened then is what happens today when we do that, is that people kind of glaze over. They disengage. They feel nothing. So Jesus, as a lostologist, did something totally different. He knew that to change the way these folks felt about the outsiders, He was going to have to capture their hearts. He was going to have to take something they already knew and which still gave them some sense of emotion and help them transfer that to what He was trying to get them to feel about these people. So Jesus simply did something He did quite commonly. He told them a story. He told them a story about a lost sheep. Now see, these people all understood that. They knew what it was like to have shepherds who would lose sheep. And so immediately they connected and engaged them emotionally. He then told them a story about a woman with a lost coin. Well, they could identify with that. They had been there. They had lost things of value. So immediately there was something that took place. And then He told them a story about a father with a lost son. Once again, He engaged them emotionally. Now, His purpose in doing that was to try to somehow get them activated so they could have a connection that was more than just cognitive. There was something connecting with the heart. Now, in its essence, that's what lostology is. And what we want to do this week is to help you learn how to do that same process. We want to learn how to take our experiences that give us that emotion and to transfer that to what we're trying to learn about spiritual truths and spiritual lostness. How many of you here, let's just do a quick survey again, how many of you have ever been lost? Okay. How many got lost getting to Glorietta? Could I see your hands? We got some folks. How many got lost getting here this morning? How many of you tend to get lost more than the average person? How many of you are sitting next to a person who gets lost more than the average person? How many are sitting next to a liar who won't admit that? Could I see those hands? Yes, it's true. We know this. Now, you see, we've got a problem today because in our culture, we feel like that lost is a bad thing. Now, we're going to talk about this quite a bit this week, but I'll say that in my research, I have determined that, generally speaking, guys have a bigger problem with this than girls do. I don't think any of us like it, but for guys, lost is just a really distasteful experience. Guys, I'm on target here. You know, I mean, it's just one of those things. We don't like it, I don't like it, so, you know, we're with it. Now, what we find in Jesus, though, is that Jesus had some totally different concept of being lost. I mean, it's like he just repackaged this whole thing, redefined it. Here's how Jesus did it. Jesus said, you know, if you're lost, that implies that there is some place you're supposed to be, and you're not there. If you're supposed to be over here and you're over there, that means you're lost. You're not where you're supposed to be. Okay, we got that. So if somebody is someplace, but there's no place they're supposed to be, you could say they lack direction, but they're not lost, right? In the same way, if you're someplace, but nobody gives a flying hang why you're there or where you are, you could say, man, I really feel lonesome, but you couldn't say, I'm lost. On the other hand, if you're someplace and there is somebody that cares that you're not where you're supposed to be, you could say, wow, I'm lost. But you see, you cannot declare yourself to be lost. It is very inappropriate for somebody to stand up and say, ooh, ouch, I'm lost. Sorry, sound guys. Okay, you can't just say that. Jesus stepped up and said, look, I've got good news for you. I want you to know that from my perspective, you are lost. Here's how it works. You see, your Father in heaven wants you in a relationship with Him. You're not in that relationship. You're someplace else. So guess what? In reference to that place, you're lost. In the same way, your Father in heaven cares so desperately that you're not in that relationship that He is willing to launch a search and rescue operation for you. He cares so much that you are not where you're supposed to be that you are lost. And so Jesus, forever and for always, defined lost as one of the greatest experiences that people can have. That's why the gospel is good news. You see, most people don't know that it's a big deal and a good deal to be lost. We get to tell. Now this morning, all we're going to try to do is just lay the framework for this, and I want to help you see how the process of lostology works. All we want to get accomplished this morning is for you to see how to make it work so you can leave here today, and maybe you'll want to get lost on purpose this afternoon just to see if it's working good for you, okay? So after you see it, it's one of those things that you're going to get it, you'll never forget it, and from now on, whenever you get lost or lose anything, you're going to learn about evangelism. Here's how it goes, and we'll tell you one of my stories just to kind of share with you how it happened with me. Now, I'm originally from Dallas. Got any Texas people here? Yes, yes, yes. Okay, but I left Texas and went to the Northwest. We got any people from Washington, Oregon? I went from there back to Nashville, Tennessee. We got anybody from Tennessee? Were those guys all last week? Oh, very small, but you're here. I'm with you. Okay. So I've got this experience of being just in 1992 moving to Nashville, and that was really my first time on the other side of the river. You know that river? Things are a lot different on that side of the river. I had lived my whole life on this side of the river going west. I got an invitation in the fall of 1992, the Monday before Thanksgiving, to go to Kentucky. Anybody here from Kentucky? Really? I got an invitation to go to Princeton, Kentucky. Anybody here from Princeton, Kentucky? Anybody ever vacationed in Princeton, Kentucky? No. Okay, you'll know why here in a minute. Okay, I got this invitation to go and speak for a meeting in Princeton, Kentucky. A very nice man named Harold called me up and said, hey, we'd like for you to come talk to our group. I said, great. Had never been to Kentucky before in my whole life, much less to Princeton. And one of the things that qualifies me to be a lostologist is that I get lost more than the typical person. So I've learned over the years to be real careful when people ask me to come place. I said, now, Harold, I really am going to need some good directions. He said, hey, no problem. I'm going to write you a letter, and this will tell you all you need to know. So I saved Harold's letter, and I want to read you what he's got here. He said, Princeton is 2 hours from Nashville right off of I-24. I mean, you know, that sounded really simple. I mean, I thought, wow, I mean, this is good. I mean, here Harold wants me to come to his meeting, and he's sent me these directions, and yet, I don't know, I just kind of had this gut hunch that maybe there was something more to it, because that just sounded too simple. So I had my assistant call Harold, and I said, you know, she said, you know, is there anything else you need to tell us? So Harold sent back some more stuff. I want to read you kind of the next draft. He said, take I-24 to the first Princeton exit. The first exit. You know, that's kind of a thing you didn't want to leave out that all those other times. And then he said, this should be Highway 139. You know, I don't like that should word very much. I mean, it either is or it isn't. I want somebody that just nails that down. He says, go about 10 miles into Princeton. I don't like the about word very much. I want to know. He says, take Highway 62 through town. Now, what we're going to find out is the concept of through town in Princeton is kind of a judgment call. I'll tell you about that here in a minute. Turn left on Druthers. This should be Highway 62. You got the should word again. Go a couple of blocks. You know, that's sort of indefinite. It is on Highway 62 and Kentucky Avenue. Well, I decided I was going to do this, so I had my little directions there from Harold in hand, and I headed up the Monday before Thanksgiving, left Nashville on my way, my first trip to Princeton, Kentucky. It was going to be great. Well, I found that first Princeton exit. I thought, well, this is working out pretty well. I pulled off, and as soon as I got off that little, you know, exit road, there's this kind of access road, and then, I mean, by this time, it is absolutely pitch black. And I'm looking, and all there is one narrow two-lane road that goes off into this pasture. No sign, no nothing. Now, what I'm looking for is Highway 139. And I'm thinking, maybe in Kentucky they've got a different concept of highways than, you know, what I had in Dallas. You know, I didn't know. I mean, it looked like my only option, so I commit myself to this thing. I'm tooling down this little two-lane road. We're going out. It's dark. But the good thing in that time of year is that the lights of Greater Princeton begin to rise out of the darkness. It's kind of like one of those backlit lightings on a Spielberg movie, you know, where it lights up behind them. Well, I thought, well, this is good. I mean, we're going towards something, and all of a sudden I see the Kiwanis sign. It's saying, welcome to Princeton. Man, I was relieved. I stopped once I got into town because I wanted to check my map one more time. I said, okay, here's where I am. I've got to find Highway 62. Well, I noticed there was a little sign up not too far from where I was that pointed me to Highway 62. But this was something even smaller than Highway 139. In fact, in a previous life, this had been a cow pasture, I determined after kind of winding, a cow path as I was winding my way through it. I go down a little bit, and all of a sudden, I'm trying to figure out, now Harold said you're supposed to go through town. Now, does that mean that as soon as you see downtown, you stop, and then that's where the turn is, or do you go all the way through town? Well, I was going through, and I'm looking for downtown, you know, the skyscrapers and stuff. And so, you know, I'm trying to figure it out, and you know, I started seeing these buildings, and I'm going, well, you know, that maybe that's downtown, but maybe it's not, you know. And so I was really undecided. I still hadn't seen this other street. And so I said, okay, I've got it. This must be through town, like out in the suburbs of Princeton. You haven't been to Princeton, nor had I. I didn't realize Princeton's a long way from having suburbs. But anyway, I stayed on the road and just kept right on going. The lights of Greater Princeton went down. I'm going back into the darkness, and I'm going out a long, long way. Suddenly, I see signs for some obscure lake out here. And I had a sense I wasn't getting any closer to this church. I pull off to the side, and I began to have a moment of reflection. I thought about Harold. And I decided right then I didn't like Harold very much. I also thought about the predicament that Harold had put me in. Here I was out in who knows where. If my car had happened to croak off right then, I could have died out there by this lake. Nobody knew where I was. I could have been there for months, and they wouldn't have even known where to look for me. So finally, I made the only decision you can make. I turned around, backtracked, headed into town, and when I got to the edge of town, I did the unthinkable. I stopped at a convenience store. I opened the door, and I hate it. I just hate it. Usually it doesn't come to this. I mean, my motto is, it's never bad enough to stop and ask directions. I mean, that's the way I feel. But I was about to miss this meeting. I walk in, I'm trying to look confident, I've got my suit on, I'm ready to go, I mean, I'm looking good, I'm trying to not look all flustered. I open the door and the worst thing that could possibly be true was true. There behind the counter were two 15, 16 year old kids. I'm feeling like I've got the sack over my head that says, hi, I'm lost and I'm stupid. That's what I'm feeling, okay? I walk up and I say to these kids, hey, do you all know where this church is? They just give me one of these looks. That is not an encouraging look. But then all of a sudden this kid kind of comes to life. I said, oh yeah, I know where that is. He says, I'm going to draw you a map. Okay, so he gets out a pencil and he kind of starts putting down a map. Now, I saved that map. I want to show you that map right here. Now, I realize you can't see it, but it doesn't matter because that map doesn't go anywhere in America. Let me just tell you, there's no place that map goes. I tried to follow that map. I just left. I was so embarrassed. I was about to miss my meeting. It was going bad. That night, actually, in all of my lost experiences, ranks is probably the worst because I got so confused I had to do the double unthinkable. I stopped another place and asked directions, and they didn't know either. Finally, by trial and error and elimination, I mean, Princeton, fortunately, was not very big, I found the church. I walk in, and Harold comes out to me, and the first thing he says is, hi, did you have any trouble getting here? I really wanted to kill Harold right then. You know, it was one of those things that I was about to preach. It wouldn't look good, and so I thought, I'll kill him after I preach, and so by then, I was through, you know, I did my little deal, and Harold and I were, you know, talking, and it was better. I wasn't quite so mad at him. He's an older man. I didn't want to kill an older guy. So, you know, I said, Harold, tell me, how long have you lived in Princeton? He said, well, that's interesting. I'm in my 28th year. And suddenly, the whole thing came together for me. Suddenly I understood the answer to the question I'd been asking myself, which was this. Why did a guy like that give me such pathetic directions? You know the answer now, don't you? You see, Harold was a Princeton, Kentucky insider. He had been inside so long that he couldn't see it from the outsider's perspective. Harold didn't know how confusing Highway 162 is at night. He didn't know that it's tough to know when you're through town. He didn't know that it's tricky sometimes to know if you're going to go about this far or that far. Harold thought he was being helpful. He was motivated. He wanted me at his meeting. But you know what? He ended up confusing me. Now let me ask you another question that's probably the most important we'll ask this morning. How many of you here grew up in and around the church, have been exposed to the gospel, and kind of been around the whole Christian thing all of your life? Could I see your hands? Hold them up. Okay, everybody look around. Keep them up, and I want you to look around. Okay, thanks. You can put them down. For the last few years, I've been asking that question every place I go speak. No matter what the setting is, if I'm with Christians, that's the response. Now, what that means is not bad necessarily. What it means, though, is that all of us are just like me, which is that we're spiritual insiders. Who is it that is supposed to go out and help these folks over here, the spiritual outsiders? Who's supposed to help them? Well, it's us. It's us. It's those of us who are inside. But we have a hard time relating to it. We're just like Harold. You see, we've been inside so long, we don't get it anymore. You can tell us to try to get in their shoes, but we don't connect. You can't tell me, think about what it was like when you were lost. I mean, I knew about Christ my whole life. I professed my faith when I was a little kid. I've had lots of growth along the way and lots of ups and downs, but I've always known about it. It's impossible for me to remember what it's like as an adult to come into a church setting for the first time. Let me give you a couple insights here. Have you ever asked yourself why people that are non-Christians, that are just checking out church or whatever, when they come in, they sit on the very back row? Because they don't know what's about to go on. They don't know if it's going to get weird. And so if it's going to get weird, they want to be close to an exit. Do you do the same thing? When you're in a new environment where you're uncomfortable, don't you kind of guard your back a little bit, kind of leave an escape route? Ask you another question. Have you ever noticed that in church a lot of time people come in there with those babies and stuff and little kids all goosing around, and the pastor will say something like, we have wonderful nursery facilities provided with trained workers, and you know, basically what he's saying is get those kids out of here and go put them in the nursery. The people just sit there, just rocking the little baby. You know, if they're a non-Christian person just checking that out, they're sitting there going, no way in the world I'm going to put my baby back there. I don't know what those people are going to do to him. There's no way I'm putting him back there. You see, they are scared because this is new to them. Now, what we've got to do is to find a way to dig deep into our emotions that we already have and use those to give us insights into what these people are thinking and feeling. This week, what we're going to challenge you to do is to go through that process, to begin to experience what it's like to take those emotions and to transfer them into evangelism. As we close, I want to tell you one quick story and see maybe how you would have responded in a similar situation. I'd like to propose this for you to think about. Suppose that last night during the concert out in the square, that all of a sudden, the big middle of that, a fellow in some outdoor gear had come walking up through the crowd. He's got a radio strapped on his front, kind of crackling, making some noise. He's looking around trying to find his way, obviously looking for somebody. He wanders around and maybe, you know, you're not even noticing him, but a few people do. They look at him. All of a sudden, this guy walks up to some of the directors and some of the NSM staff, and they kind of huddle up, and some more people kind of look at him over here, and then they go up, and together, somebody goes up on stage, and they stop the band from performing, and they get on the microphone, and they say, would Scott Allen come to the front? We need to see Scott for just a minute. Scott's the coordinator of this week for National Student Ministries. In just a second, Scott comes to the front, where all the people are gathered. He and this fellow with the outdoor gear talk for a minute, and then Scott steps up to the microphone and says this, I want to introduce you here to Craig Bannerman, the regional search and rescue coordinator for this area. He has an announcement. At that point, this fellow steps up to the microphone and he says this, I'm sorry to interrupt your program tonight, but we have an emergency situation and we need your help. We have three college students who are missing in the woods. Their names are Paula Smith, Sarah Creason, and Kimberly Zimmerman. Apparently they were hiking this afternoon and have not returned. Normally I have enough volunteers to help with a situation like this, but right now I have 15 of my men in Utah fighting fire, so I need your help. If any of you have outdoor experience and have any gear with you, I'd like to meet you in the back. You'll need to be prepared to be gone for at least 8 to 10 hours, if not more. Again, I'm sorry to interrupt your program, but I appreciate your help. Then he leaves the stage. All right, now, just for a minute, imagine that is what happened last night. You got it? Think about it. The concert is stopped. There's a guy up there at the front. He's appealing for you to stop what you're doing. Go help search for three students. Here's my question to you. What would you do? What would you feel? How many of you would have gotten up from that experience, left what you were doing, and gone back to Craig and said, I can help that search effort? How many of you might have just had that sense of feeling, oh man, I can't believe that, you know, so concerned? Or let me ask you another question. How many of you might have been kind of put out that this is stopping the concert and that you're just kind of irritated about the whole thing? You see, most of us are never in a situation like that, so we really don't know. Now, probably if I asked you to make some sort of indication today of how you'd respond, we all tend to think we'd do real well. I mean, probably most of you would say, well, sure, I'd help. I mean, not me. I wouldn't have been irritated or anything. People are lost. I want to help. Friends, let me tell you that if you had been with us last Saturday night in Ridgecrest, North Carolina, this wouldn't have been something you would have had to wonder about because that situation happened. Let me tell you how those students responded. In that moment, as Craig stepped to the back, immediately 20, 25 students, guys and gals, went to the back and met him there, ready to do whatever was required. There was a real hush that fell on the auditorium, and some people began to just pray. They were so taken in their concern for these students that were missing. Everybody stood just silent right there in that moment. It was one of the most powerful moments of time that I've ever experienced personally. Now, I want to tell you what I was feeling. I was scared to death. You want to know why? Not for those students, because you see, I was part of the setup. We had made the decision, and I'd suggested that we try to give the students the experience of what it would feel like to be put in a crisis situation, to have to make a decision, not an academic exercise, but to know for sure when the appeal was given, would you get up? Would you leave? Would you help? Would you stay put and just be irritated that they had interrupted your concert? I wanted them to know what they would do. As it turned out, my fears were set aside because that group of students, the energy that came to the surface was incredible. So strong was their desire to help that everything became secondary. The only reason we didn't do that with you last night is that we discovered in the evaluation that that experience was so powerful and compelling for those students that it made it very difficult for them to get back into the evening. So we made the decision not to do it with you. So unfortunately today, I have to ask you the academic question. How would you respond? What I said to those students last Sunday morning was that I was very encouraged by their response because what I knew is that they still had the capacity to care deeply. Now, why is that so important? Because of this. Because in churches across America today, the appeal will go out. Someone will say, you know, we've got 3 people that are spiritually lost. We need some volunteers to interrupt their schedules and to join the search. And people across America are going to sit there and do absolutely nothing. This week, I'd like for you to ask yourself this question, and only you can answer it. If you'd been there last Saturday night, what would you have done? What would you really have done? And here's the most important question. When you hear the truth, which is that spiritually people are lost all around us, what are you going to do when that appeal goes out? Let's stop for a moment of prayer. Our Father, we thank You that You've called us to be part of Your rescue team. We're thankful that we still have the capacity to care and to think and to feel. Father, we pray that You'd use that energy that You put in our life, the concern in our hearts, to give us that ability to reach out to people who are spiritually lost. In Jesus' name we pray.